I'm joined by Professor Andrew Scoble from the RAND Corporation. Andrew, welcome to the Lowy Institute. You've just given a lecture for us on China's search for security and where Australia fits in China's worldview. But I'd like to take you, first of all, to look at the relationship between the US and China. You've outlined some grand view of China's strategic view of the world and these various mutually reinforcing trifocals, as you put them, ideology, culture, etc. But I just wonder to what extent China, when it looks out at the world, engages in mirror imaging behavior across the Pacific when it looks at the United States.
China, and for that matter, many in China, and for that matter, many in the United States, think that culture is an important variable. And so that, in other words, China is not the same as the United States, and vice versa. And I think there's general agreement in Beijing and Washington that there are, while states tend to operate in certain ways, culture does matter. So to the extent there's mirror imaging, what I would suggest is that it's mirror imaging of rationality. And what I mean by that is China understands the U.S. is different from China, and yet especially in tense situations, when key decisions are made or key policies are initiated by the other, even though the recognition that there are these important cultural differences, when push comes to shove, the default position amongst Chinese leaders when they're looking at what the U.S. is doing, thinking, and trying to put themselves in the U.S. shoes, they tend to mirror image rationality. In other words, what China would do, why China would do what the U.S. is doing, try and understand what the U.S. is doing, even though there is idealism is not absent from Chinese thinking and Chinese foreign policy and national security decision making. It tends to be more of a Machiavellian strand that takes preeminence. And so whatever the U.S. does tends to be seen in either one of two ways. Either it's a nefarious plot or scheme to try and do something to really surprise or throw China a curveball or googly. Or it is seen as something rather irrational. The U.S. is acting erratically. It makes it difficult if you're sitting in Washington trying to sincerely reach out to China. Because if you offer them a carrot, there's immediate suspicion. Why is the U.S. doing this? This mirror imaging of rationality, as I see it, is a tremendous challenge. But I think it's inaccurate to talk about blanket mirror imaging, because I think Chinese leaders certainly see the U.S. as very different culturally and politically to China.
I was intrigued that you said that Chinese leaders have drunk the Kool-Aid of globalization and that thinking globally demands acting globally. One thing I often hear as China moves out into the world that it's following a template that's not all that dissimilar to other rising great powers. But one way in which it's been different, at least up to this point, is that it hasn't consciously pursued formal alliances with other states, with the exceptions of DPRK, which of course is a rather imperfect ally, to put it mildly, and Pakistan. But beyond that, it becomes a very thin gruel indeed. So I put the question to you, to what extent does China need allies? And is that question likely to change, particularly as it acquires global interests that require a globally supporting infrastructure militarily that might even include bases in future?
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting question. Of course, China tends to criticize the U.S. for having a Cold War mentality. That's a key manifestation is an alliance structure, especially in the Asia Pacific. That's seen as, from a Chinese perspective, why do you need these allies? Who's the enemy? And they, not surprisingly, come to the conclusion that perhaps they're seen as the enemy. And so alliances is what other countries do, not what China does. And of course, China, as you suggest, as an ally, official ally right now, formal ally, as you alluded to, is also a sorry excuse for an ally. But China's had some alliance experiences. They haven't tended to end well, particularly, of course, most notably the Sino-Soviet alliance. And China doesn't have left that with a bad taste in its mouth. And yet, China's, I think, starting to rethink this whole question of alliances, because now they have global interests. Now they're much more active around the world. Their citizens are spread out. Their economic interests are spread out. And the question arises, how do you protect those interests? And so of course, there are a couple different ways. One, you can try and do it all yourself, but that can get very expensive, and it may be just infeasible to do, just not possible. So the closest thing that China has come to alliances are developing these, you know, strategic partnerships that they have established with a wide range of countries. But there has been a debate amongst Chinese scholars and some think tankers about whether China needs to rethink this whole alliance question, because it may make a lot of sense. And as you mentioned overseas bases. In Djibouti, China has established some kind of facility. I don't think they're calling it a base, but interestingly, the Djiboutians are calling it a base. But why do they have it? Because I think it's the recognition that China needs facilities that it can use for its naval vessels to use that are ranging further afield, and especially in the Gulf of Aden and the Persian Gulf region, where they've had ships on anti-piracy patrols. So this is, there has been a significant rethink by the Chinese. And yet that flies in the face of China-proud claims that they don't have a single foreign base, they don't station any troops abroad. And so they wouldn't be able to make that, it would be harder to make that claim if they changed their thinking and actually acted to establish, formal or de facto alliances.
You mentioned the experience of the Sino-Soviet split as a cautionary influence on Chinese thinking. But one relationship now that's coming back, in a sense, to the future is the Russia-China relationship. It's something that we at the Institute will be publishing on in the near future. And I wondered what your take is on that. Is there substance to that beyond an alignment? And to what extent is this likely to gather momentum, or will the contradictions between the old, the Russia of old and the China of old basically be the same undoing as it was in another ideological guise in the 1960s?
Yeah, it's an interesting relationship to look at between Moscow and Beijing. And I think there's significant mutual distrust, and yet they have common cause. China and Russia feel as if they've been unnecessarily maligned and persecuted by the West and misunderstood. And so they have common cause in trying to coordinate responses to the West and to the United States. And so I think that's a big part of it. But I do see limitations on the two sides' ability to move from an alignment to a formal alliance. And yet, barring some worsening of relations with the U.S. and the West, which might push them closer together in say a conflict situation, heaven forbid. And yet, the bar is still relatively low. They need each other, but at a very basic level, neither Russia nor China wants to have instability or turmoil along their border. And so at a minimum, if they're talking to each other, if they have cordial relations and their common border is stable, that may be, that basically answers the mail for their relationship to be a win-win.
I'd like to direct your focus now to Australia's part in China's worldview. For the last few years, it's been a fairly easy ride for Australia in terms of being able to have its cake in the form of a close economic relationship sealed with an FTA recently, and eat it too in the form of the US alliance relationship. But I think the great strategic question that people are asking in Australia is to what extent this can be a sustainable status quo. And we've had a recent challenge towards that, rhetorically at least, in the form of an excoriating editorial from the Global Times newspaper at the weekend. I just wondered, as a visitor into Australia, looking from a macro level at China's strategic traditions and global view, whether you see any change in this view towards Australia.
China sees Australia as a quite important country in the region, important source of minerals and so on. So economically important. There's also Australia is important as a place for Chinese students to study, as well as tourists and business people. But of course, Australia is also seen as a staunch U.S. ally. This isn't viewed so positively by China, understandably. And I think that Australia is in the same boat, so to speak, as virtually every other country in East Asia, with the exception of glow-in-the-dark North Korea. And that is that they're in China's orbit economically, at the same time trying to maintain, security relationship with the United States. And so far, most countries have been able to do that delicate dance, or balancing act. And so there's no reason why Australia shouldn't be able to maintain that that balancing act as well. Of course, there are likely to be crises, and this may further test or stretch, make it much more challenging for countries in the region, including Australia. And yet, I think there's every reason to think that that Australia can continue to have its cake and eat it too. As again, that's not to say that there won't be difficulties and challenges along the way, but China has limits. Going back to the editorial you mentioned, not to minimize the real economic, or the real hard power, military and economic power that China has, if it wants to punish a country or hold it accountable. But China has tended to be in the arena of threats, and its bark has tended to be more worse than its bite. That's not to say China has not attempted to use leverage when it feels like another country is trying to is doing unfriendly things or acting against China's interests. But when China has tried to use leverage, it's been in a very limited form for a rather limited time. And I think that's mainly because China realizes that it's shooting itself in the foot. And there are examples, bananas with the Philippines, rare earth with Japan. And that did occur for a limited period of months, but eventually China moved on, trying to make the point, signal that it was not happy. And I think those signals are not just to the country, specific country concerned, but there's also a domestic dimension. And so that Global Times editorial was as much for domestic consumption within China as it was meant as a signal to Australia.
You've said that Xi Jinping is perhaps the strongest leader China has had, even since Mao, if not Deng Xiaoping. I just would like to interrogate you a bit more about how important the personality of this man is to China's strategic view. To what extent is he able to direct the supertanker X many degrees to the right or the left?
Well, actually, I think is that not that he's the most powerful, but he's the most ambitious. He may be, but I think he's definitely the most ambitious. Just in terms of the number of major initiatives, both foreign and domestic, that he's launched in very early in his tenure, his first five-year term as president and general secretary and chairman of the Central Military Commission, the troika of positions Chinese leaders have to feel like they have to have in order to burnish their their authority and exert their influence. I think time, it's too soon to tell. It's very clear he's the most ambitious. Only it's too soon to say whether he's the strongest, because we'll have to wait and see. The next party Congress would be a good indicator of that. But I think also the true test of Xi Jinping will be how he deals with a major setback, whether that's economic or otherwise. If for example, there's a major setback in the South China Sea, or
is the PCA Hague ruling, does that pass the definition of a major test?
I don't think so. China, Beijing's been shaping things even before the announcement, because the assumption was that it would go against China. Even if perhaps the only surprise was that it was so emphatic in its condemnation of Chinese behavior and policy. But there was no expectation that it would be anything but ruling against China. So I think the danger of that is ruling is that it may become irrelevant if other countries do not try and hold China accountable and persist in this, because I think otherwise it's very easy this will slip away and it'll be a important legal case in international law, and that's about it.
Andrew Scoble, thank you very much for sharing your insights with the Lowy Institute today.
You're welcome.